As you look around you at the things in the world you'd like to change, maybe you wonder how you could have an impact. Lots of us get stirred up enough to at least think about getting into action. Today's guest has plenty of ideas about how people can engage in their communities. The book we'll talk about is The Activist's Handbook. Its original version is more than two decades old, and the world has changed in many ways since then. So the book changed to keep up. The handbook is now out in a second edition. Randy Shaw is its author. He's the director of the Tenderloin Housing Clinic in San Francisco. He helped found it in 1980. He's also the editor of BeyondCron.org. He's been our guest in the past to talk about his book on Cesar Chavez and the United Farm Workers, Beyond the Fields. Randy Shaw, welcome back to The Exchange.
Thanks for having me.
So tell us a bit about the place that you spend most of your time. What is the Tenderloin Housing Clinic?
Well, the Tenderloin Housing Clinic is the city's largest provider of permanent housing to homeless single adults. We lease 16 hotels, and we end up sort of paying the rent for over 2,500 people. We run the hotels, we manage the hotels, and we also pay rent for people. So we're a giant homeless operation, homeless housing operation, permanent housing. We also are very active in tenant advocacy and organizing in San Francisco and actually statewide on a lot of issues. So a lot of work around residential hotels, but also just tenant issues and land use issues in San Francisco.
Has the job gotten significantly harder over the years as scuzzy neighborhoods seek to gentrify in San Francisco?
Well, I always say, and this is the subject of a future book of mine, that the Tenderloin will be the only working class neighborhood in any central city left in the United States, because we've taken, and it's part of what I have in the Activist Handbook is how that happened. We took a lot of proactive measures in the 80s to protect this neighborhood from future gentrification, and those measures have really held up. Despite the skyrocketing rents, we're in San Francisco now, studio apartments are going for over $2,000, two bedrooms over $3,000. There's just skyrocketing rents, but the Tenderloin, we've kept so much of the housing stock off the speculative market, which again is a kind of proactive strategy that I talk about in the Activist Handbook.
Well, and as you point out, it's very different in other cities. In fact, I think the New Yorker itself referred to Manhattan as a gated community for the wealthy now, so not a similar situation there, for example.
Right. No, Manhattan is a gated. That's a very apt description. But, we've done a lot of things. I think the biggest thing, which just sort of became the chapter one of the book, because I came to the Tenderloin in 1980 when we faced this humongous battle against three luxury hotels. We realized at that time that even though it was a historically residential neighborhood, the zoning allowed high-rise commercial development. I mean, you could build 50-story high-rises in the residential Tenderloin and tear down entire blocks. So we got a zoning change, a rezoning of the entire neighborhood passed in 1985, which really prevented the kind of development that often gentrifies New York and other cities.
So let's talk about then what has happened since you began with the Tenderloin Housing Clinic. And when exactly was the first edition of the Activist's Handbook put out?
Well, it came out in 96, and, it was timely for the time. And Saul Alinsky's books, Rules for Radicals and All, still do are great sellers and all. But, I realized that there's something called the Internet, which has since developed, which was not in the original edition. And so many activists are using social media and everything that did not include the Internet. The gay rights movement just really took off. The immigrant rights movement, which really wasn't much before 1990 when the first book came out. So, and then the opportunity to talk about how people dealt with the Obama presidency when I previously had only talked about Clinton. So just a lot of opportunities to really make it a better book.
Well, given the Internet, obviously there are lots of ways that people can connect with each other that they couldn't with the first edition of the Activist Handbook. On balance, though, being given some of the new obstacles that have arisen as well as the new pathways to connection like the Internet, are things about the same for activists in terms of degree of difficulty, do you think?
I actually think the new tools have given us a tremendous edge in a lot of ways. I mean, it used to be that activists would do an event, and if the local newspaper didn't cover it, then it was like a tree falling in the forest. No one heard it. Now you can tweet your own event. You can send photos to Instagram. You can put it on Facebook. And more people are likely to see what you did than if it just was in a conventional newspaper, especially since readership of daily newspapers is down. So the kind of role of media gatekeeper that activists were sort of stuck with has really changed, and I think that's a humongous boost that you're no longer dependent on, often corporate-owned media to, and especially if you're working, like in my area, tenants issues, which the corporate media tends not to support, now you can get the word out yourself. So I think that's been a huge boost for a lot of progressive causes.
You write about the stature of activists whose names are well-known in American history, recent American history, Rosa Parks, Cesar Chavez, and Rachel Carson among them, their stature growing over time. Who do you see of that stature working as activists today?
Well, I think there's a lot of great activists. I mean, Bill McKibben is really, you know, I give him a lot of credit for making the Keystone issue, really elevating the Keystone issue. He's at 350.org. There's activists in all kinds, you know, Van Jones, who does a blurb for the book, but is, you know, out there really using a high-profile platform to promote progressive causes. But, you know, the historical activists, Rosa Parks, you know, became famous later, right? And, of course, Sister Chavez was a labor leader. But I think now it's really the rank-and-file people who are doing work who often don't seek credit. I mean, Eliseo Medina, who I wrote about in my prior book and also briefly in this book, who has gotten more acclaim recently due to his fast. But there's a lot of people doing great work, but also a lot of it's behind the scenes, because often the best activists, like Fred Ross, who trained Cesar Chavez and Dolores Huerta, is far less known than those people, right?
True, but that raises a question, and I'll make it brief because we're close to a break, but is it better sometimes of activism if the campaign has less of a visible face, because then that person becomes a target, lightning rod, whatever?
Well, that's a great point. That's a great, great point, which we can discuss more after your break.
Thank you for recognizing the music coming up. Randy Shaw is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is The Activist's Handbook, now in its second edition. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange when we return from this break. Back with Randy and you in a minute 10. Here we are again on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Randy Shaw, activist and the director of the Tenderloin Housing Clinic in San Francisco, which he helped found in 1980. He has heavily rewritten his Activist's Handbook of the mid-90s. It's now the Activist's Handbook, second edition by Randy Shaw, about how to affect change in your community. Join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Email address jx@jeffnet.org. So, personalities in activism. I mean, yes, we have great names like Rosa Parks, Cesar Chavez, and Rachel Carson. As you point out, a lot of their work was done by the time they were recognized for it, certainly. But that does raise the question of how good or bad it is to have a really noticeable person in front of your activist effort.
Well, usually it's not something you want. I mean, I think it's interesting. I write about the Occupy movement in the book, and, you know, Occupy was intentionally had no leaders, right? And that was one of its attraction, that there were no leaders, there were no star personalities, because what we learned in the 1960s movements with Vietnam, like, the media would appoint, basically the corporate media would decide who to interview and who to elevate, and it often caused resentment among other people about why that person was being held out and their opinions were carried. So I think the popularity, one of the reasons for the popularity of the Occupy movement, for example, was there was no stars. There wasn't a person identified, and I think that's true. Immigrant rights movement, I mean, I know the people, Eliseo Medina and people like that, Maria Elena DeRazzo, but the average person doesn't really know them. It's more of a movement. Same thing with gay and lesbian rights movement that we've seen. There's, you know, you can name well-known people, but it's mostly just activists who are not as, who are known in their circles, and that's generally better for movements.
You write in the book, Randy, that the media will never promote young people's activism as it did in the 1960s. Why not?
Well, because it's no longer news. It seems like, you know, there was a period of time where the media was really excited that there was student activism and everything got covered. And now, and I argue, I have a whole new chapter in the book on the rise of student activism, it doesn't get covered as much. So the anti-sweatshop movement in the United States, which is almost entirely driven by student activism for the United Students Against Sweatshops, you don't read stories about the people, and you, most of your listeners are, can not name a person affiliated with the group or what they've even done. And in California, we had this huge, massive campaign around tuition increases, which only got publicity when at UC Davis a bunch of folks were pepper sprayed. But those were students taking the lead, being far more active than, I mean, it was one thing when there was a Vietnam War and people were afraid of being drafted. Of course they're going to be active. But it's been very difficult, you know, to get people to fight tuition increases, to fight sweatshops, which, you know, are overseas. Students don't get the credit, and that's why I'm really glad that I could have a whole chapter really sort of highlighting how much students have done. And I also talk, I know Eugene is in this area, I believe, at Jefferson Public Radio.
Yes.
I have a section about the war on student activism that is occurring at places like the University of Oregon and other so-called progressive campuses.
A war in what sense? I mean, what are some of the tactics used
against
students?
Well, the administration really trying to tamp down student activism, in this case of Augsburg, on the University of Oregon campus at Eugene, because, you know, with the decline, particularly during the recession, of public dollars to universities, they want to raise more money from private donors who often are the corporate interests that groups like Augsburg oppose. And so it was like, we want to try to defund these groups. And this occurred, or stop Purg chapters from occurring, which occurred in a number of California schools. So the administration's desire for private dollars means they just don't want anti-corporate activities by their students.
I certainly hear an ongoing concern about corporations and their influence. I want to come back to the when you talk about the corporate media, because you made the reference a couple of times now. Do you not see the corporate media? Yes, they're consolidated now, but I mean, at the time that you started in activism around 1980, for example, CBS News, I think, was not even required to make a profit to the network at that point. Now these are all money-making bodies that were not originally.
No, it's changed so dramatically. I mean, the biggest change might be with like the LA Times being purchased by the whole Tribune Company and all the papers. The LA Times, one of the great newspapers historically. I grew up in LA, and then Sam Zell, a real estate developer, buys it and just wrecks the entire chain of paper. You see the Philadelphia Inquirer, which used to be one of the great newspapers. No, the profit maximization, which has taken over the corporate media, is a tragedy. There's no question about it.
Let's talk about tactical activism. That's one. There's several kinds of activism you bring up in here, but let's start with tactical activism and what that is.
Well, I mean, I think sort of the whole theme of the book is, you know, when people want to go out and make money, go to your bookstore or your library, and there's a whole shelf of books that talk about tactics and strategies to make more money, right? But when we're looking at how to be effective activists, we often don't really have books that say which tactics work and which tactics don't. And we sort of feel like, well, gee, if you just work hard and you have a good heart, you may succeed. But actually, the whole purpose of the Activist Handbook is to say to people, no, there are certain tactics that over time, and I use case studies, work, and others that don't work. For example, there are certain times when you can block traffic, or if you're hitting offending people and you have the right target, people will tolerate being inconvenienced. But as I say, if you go on the Golden Gate Bridge and you want to make a statement and educate people about the AIDS crisis, and you're just, you know, blocking and inconveniencing random drivers who probably agree with your cause, but they're not in a position of power, that's a bad tactic. And so you want to use the tactics most likely to lead you to success.
But then how do you figure out which those might be? I mean, you know, again, what may work as a tactic today, because people are like, oh, you know, I don't mind waiting 5 minutes with these guys parading in front of me because I agree with their cause. But then if it happens five more times in the next week, suddenly you've lost the very same people that you had in the beginning of your movement. So I mean, how do you adjust your sensitivity to account for that sort of thing?
That's a great point. And I think some people, you know, have, it's called experience. And that's, again, why I wrote the book for people who want to make to look at the experiences of what has succeeded in a whole variety of movements and what has not succeeded in the, you know. So, but that's why you need books, and that's why you need people who have experience to say, hey, you know, we tried that. I talk about a situation, you know, sometimes you do something once and it works great and you go back to it. And it's interesting, you know, I have even though most of my book is about progressive movements, I have a section on the Tea Party, because you recall in 2009, they stormed all the congressional town halls. Remember that, the August town halls?
Oh, yeah, they were awful.
And people read the book will really remind them of how the media treated this small number of people storming town halls as if it was a multi-million person movement, and called it a movement. And they said, you know what, Americans don't like health care. We thought they did, but they really don't want it, all based on a very small sampling of older white people primarily. Who were career Republicans, but they called themselves the Tea Party. So, and what was special about that was that those August town halls had always been kind of quiet affairs. And so by storming them, that was quote-unquote news. Then this past summer, they planned to do the same thing about immigration reform, and it utterly failed because the immigrant rights activists, aware of what happened in 2009, outnumbered them at the halls and actually reverted the tactic, and suddenly the stories were, gee, Tea Party fails. I guess they don't really care about opposing immigrant rights. So you go back to this, well, your opponents, the element of surprise is often the critical success, and you try to do it twice, the second time it doesn't work.
The Tea Party predates Occupy Wall Street, which is described in detail in the book. Did you think at the beginning that Occupy Wall Street was going to become something like a counterpart to the Tea Party?
Well, no, because the Tea Party was always a branch of the Republican Party. It was funded by high-profile Republicans like Dick Armey and the groups they set up, whereas Occupy was anarchist-based, and it was never going to be the left wing of the Democratic Party. I think the main message my book has about Occupy, Occupy achieved, outstanding accomplishment of putting inequality and the whole proactive approach of redefining everything as we are the 99% was absolutely brilliant. What I think really hurt the movement and kind of sort of brought it down was this, it sort of set, suddenly, because they were being arrested by police, it suddenly moved from being a movement about wage inequality and overall inequality to one about the right to camp in a public park and police brutality, and those are different issues. And I think it strayed from its core agenda, and it didn't organize to build a movement. It just kind of thought, hey, if people are interested, it'll come. But the Field of Dreams approach to organizing doesn't really work.
But here again, some of these things, you refer to the responses by government and power centers as strategically wrong. And I assume you mean some of the police responses to Occupy Wall Street, which actually did help the visibility in the early going. But here again, it seems like it's too much of one thing just doesn't work for activism over time.
Well, I think the point is if you're trying to build a movement to attack inequality, and then you're spending all your time fighting for the right to have to sleep in a public park, that's a different issue. And whereas people overwhelmingly want to attack inequality, a lot of people say, hey, like in Oakland, California, what happened was they just took over a civic center public space that city workers just have lunch in and all of a sudden it was like, well, wait a minute, why are people here with tents? Why has this become what's it have to do with inequality, the right to sleep in a public park? And so the issue shifted, and then when the authorities arrested people, it all became the police brutality, which was accurate, but that wasn't what Occupy originally was about. It was about wage inequality. So the response, they became defensive. Instead of staying on their agenda, they let their opponents define what the fight was going to be about.
Randy Shaw is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, longtime activist, the director of the Tenderloin Housing Clinic in San Francisco, and the author of The Activist's Handbook, a second time. The Activist's Handbook, now out in a second edition, heavily revised from its 1996 version to reflect things like the birth of the Internet and Occupy Wall Street and the Tea Party. Join us on the Exchange as we talk about activism and what are the tactics that work and what are the things that don't necessarily. 800-838-3760, anywhere in our listening area. Our Rogue Valley local number, 541-552-6782. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Skeeter in Eugene, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Good morning, gentlemen. I'd like to make a couple of tactical suggestions based on many years of being involved and on the streets doing a lot of this stuff. Bake sales sometimes are some of the best fundraisers in terms of how much energy goes into it. I also suggest that people organize themselves into affinity groups, 8 to 12 to 15 friends who have common values, hopefully nonviolent, but are into doing creative street theater and direct action kind of stuff in your face in a friendly, fun kind of way, but educating other folks. I really think it's important for us to not consider the so-called opposition as our enemy. We're all earthlings, and hopefully at when we're all done with this, we'll have a happy place where we're all getting together and we're happy with each other. So I think that body language, tone of voice, that kind of thing when interacting with either police or people who are in the so-called opposition, it's really important because I think essentially we're really trying to converse with people and change people's minds based on education, and educating ourselves about these issues is really important. I also think that we can organize ourselves so that those of us who have limited time and can't go to a lot of organizing meetings but are still able to offer our car for a carpool or can do poster putting up or make, any number of skills and tools that people possess that they're willing to share, I think organizers and activists can do really a benefit to all of us by, you know, making sure that we have that pool of people who are willing to help us out available. Everybody from bakers to people willing to do civil disobedience. So that way the organizers have a whole pool of people that they can call up either on the phone or internet.
And, you know, I was saying, go ahead.
Anyway, thank you. I appreciate what you're doing.
All right, thanks, Gary.
You made a lot of really great points. I just want to comment on a couple. I think of all the great things you said, I mean, one of them is that not to make your opponents into permanent enemies. And I have a whole chapter in the book about, you know, coalition activism and rounding up the unusual suspects. And I think one of the biggest mistakes that progressive activists make is that they only want to work with people who agree with them 95% of the time. Instead of saying, well, gee, we don't agree here, but here's some things we can work together on. But if you're demonizing people, they're not going to work with you on even things you agree with. So as the caller indicated, you know, to win power, you have to align with forces who may not agree with you on other issues. And you have to be open to that, as your caller said. The other thing on the affinity groups, I mean, people may, often younger people don't remember the anti-nuclear movement, anti-nuclear power movement, which was entirely based on affinity groups and was incredibly successful. One of the great successes of the 1970s was stopping nuclear power's expansion in the United States. And it highlights a really critical point. There has to be a social component. Activism is fun. I enjoy it. It's not a chore. Like, oh, God, I got to go out there on Saturday and march. It's actually fun. And the creative stuff the caller was talking about is fun. But also affinity groups and other methods make people feel connected to other people. And that's what activism and social change movements should do. It should be fun and exhilarating and meaningful. And people often look back, it's like their best time of their lives when they're real into activism. But often now people feel like, well, I don't know anyone involved. So building those social relations are very important.
You mean, in other words, they don't want to do it because their friends aren't there or something?
Well, I mean, no one wants to go. I mean, not so much your friend, but just you want to have it to be fun. I mean, you want to talk about it. You don't want to feel lonely while you're doing something. And I think groups really go out of their way to build those kind of networks now. Because people realize that's important. That is a very important part of activism, that people feel connected. That's what it's all about.
You mentioned that where the Occupy movement seemed to change ideas was when it went from being about wage inequality to the right to camp in a public place.
Yeah.
Obviously, that happened. Occupy Eugene morphed over time into something of a camping thing too, and gave birth eventually to Sleeps, which is safe, legally entitled emergency places to sleep.
Yeah.
But you're not putting down the efforts for homeless relief here.
No, because of the line of work you're in.
That
what happened was that you know, and particularly when you have an allegedly democratic process that requires people to be there till 2 a.m. on consensus votes, people with jobs and children really can't participate. I mean, let's be very honest about this, that for a movement that said it was the citadel of democracy, you can't have a structure which pretty much prevents a lot of people from participating, which was that long consensus process. And I think that's a point that, a critique that needs to be really discussed about this notion that that's the most, that this horizontal method of decision-making is the most democratic. Now, obviously, there's a terrible homeless crisis in this country, all over this country. It's one of the, you know, the biggest issue that no one talks about is rising homelessness in the United States and the federal government's refusal to do anything about it. I mean, it's a scandal. We could have show after show talking about that.
We could indeed, but I want to explore the in the book where you talk about homelessness being a failure of defensive activism.
Yeah, well, I think what's unfortunate is homelessness has become defined as panhandling and people sleeping in parks, instead of the fact that the federal government is not funding affordable housing, which reduces homelessness. I mean, that's really the tragedy, is that when people talk about homeless problem, they don't say, yeah, the homeless problem is our government doesn't provide the housing levels they used to do until the 1980s. I mean, really, from the 1949 National Housing Act, most of the population in need was getting subsidized housing. We stopped that in the 70s, eliminated it altogether almost in the 80s in terms of the percentage of people benefiting is less and less. But that's not the quote-unquote homeless problem. The homeless problem is people panhandling on a street or sleeping in a park. That's how it's been redefined. And so instead of blaming Congress or a president or society, we blame particular individuals who are homeless. And that's worked great for the people who don't want to fund permanent solutions.
Is part of the problem with no grants for affordable housing that that it got a bad name through housing projects and, you know, public housing with the, you know, the quotes around it a bad name?
I think the real core problem is that domestic spending doesn't get funded, but the ones that do get funded, like education, has teachers' unions to fight for them. There's no union power behind housing, and that makes it even harder.
No big organization to really put its weight behind that.
National developers, right.
The Activist Handbook is in its second edition. Randy Shaw is its author and our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. We will talk with him some more and take some calls and emails from you as well when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 25. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Randy Shaw, the director of the Tenderloin Housing Clinic in San Francisco, which he helped found in 1980. He's been our guest in the past. He talked about Cesar Chavez in his book about the United Farm Workers Beyond the Fields. He has revised his mid-90s The Activist's Handbook. It's now called The Activist's Handbook, Winning Social Change in the 21st Century, in a second edition to reflect all the things that have changed in the world since the mid-90s. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange about activism and the tactics and the strategies. 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, or by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We haven't talked much about electoral politics. The fact is that to get things done in this country, you generally have to work through or around or over, pick your preposition, elected officials at some point. And you quote Ernesto Cortez Jr. Talking about fear and loathing relationships with elected officials. What does he mean there?
Well, you know, I think that's one of the most talk about my book is that the fear and loathing approach to elected officials, because the reality is that while there are progressive officials who do everything they want, have a big heart, and have the same principles and don't have to be pressured, so many of our elected officials, you know, end up having to, you know, what I call, you know, be afraid of retaliation and actually end up despising the activists who helped elect them. I mean, we saw that most prominently, and I have this in the book, and I can't use the word on the air, in the Obama administration when Rahm Emanuel was chief of staff and progressives were starting to wonder in 2009 why all these things in the campaign for change weren't happening. And Obama and Emanuel was quoted saying, F the left. And, you know, basically that means they were doing their job. Meanwhile, the constituencies that were not criticizing Obama got nothing. I mean, I talk in the book how the immigrant rights community sort of trusted Obama. He said he could do stuff, and they felt betrayed at the end. The community that was trying to get rid of Don't Ask, Don't Tell went after Obama. And even though it made Rahm Emanuel mad and the Obama administration, they ended up, you know, agreeing to what they were promised to do. So it sort of says fear and loathing that often the only way that activists can get politicians to do what they say they're going to do is if they end up being feared and loathed.
So clearly don't relax when somebody who's friendly to your cause gets elected because, I mean, they make promises, but they don't always keep them. And circumstances change once they get into office and they're getting campaign donations from different people.
Yeah, or, you know, and again, I want to be clear, there's obviously exceptions to that. I'm not saying every politician is that way. I know I work with a lot of politicians who don't have to be, who totally have the same belief system and want change as badly as we do. But we just see this pattern. We saw it with, you know, here you have Bill Clinton and Al Gore getting elected in 1992. Going to this area saying, if the biggest difference between us and our opponent, Bush Quayle, is if we're elected, we'll kill this incinerator project. 3 months after they take office, they approve the incinerator project. And then, as I discussed, most environmental groups didn't say boo because they had other agendas, right? We don't want to alienate the Clinton administration 3 months in because we've got these other agendas on our plate. And that's why it's so particularly difficult for environmentalists to hold politicians accountable. And I have a big section of the book on this because they have so many issues that if you're working on forest preservation in Oregon, are you going to jeopardize your relationship with an elected official over something they did in West Virginia on a vote?
Well, and you give the example of the XL pipeline story, yeah. And of course the whole jobs versus the environment dichotomy gets pulled into play there. How do, for example, you recommend activists to work with things like first of all, the potentially false dichotomies like jobs versus the environment, or in Oregon's case, loggers versus spotted owls, as it was characterized
right.
for so long. How do you work with the terms that are framed by somebody else and with big differences in the numbers that you believe are correct versus the ones that are getting bandied about?
See, that's why I think the Internet has made such a difference and why I needed to include it in the new version of the Activist Handbook, because, you know, before, I mean, it used to be you were stuck with the numbers that they printed in the local newspaper, and maybe there was some alternative press that would have it, but now you have, you know, think tanks like Think Progress, Media Matters, and so many of these think tanks now which are coming up with our correct numbers. And on Keystone, we saw a great example where our numbers showing the truth about the jobs got just as much play, and eventually the mainstream, you know, newspaper media and TV, corporate TV media, when these other numbers are out there, they can't really ignore them. And so I think there's a great example you brought up about how in Keystone, the whole issue about jobs, you even had the president saying there weren't really that many jobs being created. So there's an example of how the Internet is such a powerful tool for getting information out that otherwise would not have been distributed.
That case in particular, the numbers were so staggeringly different. I believe you had some of the people who had really analyzed them, like maybe 2,000, 3,000 jobs. You had Rush Limbaugh saying, what, a quarter of a million or something?
Yeah, well, they just make up stuff. And it's interesting the way it's been so successful to just make up numbers, because then other media figure, well, he wouldn't say that if it wasn't true, right? Well, they do say things that aren't true. And now they're being called on it, which is why I think overall progressives have really benefited far more than conservatives from the Internet, because it's a fact check, an instant fact check.
And yet, there are situations like, oh, which senator was it on the floor of the Senate who mentioned that the one who said Planned Parenthood, 90% of its services are abortions.
Right.
And then the response when he was called on the numbers was, well, it wasn't meant to be a factual statement.
Yeah.
I mean, when people have disposing of facts and figures as if they are basically whatever I choose to make up at the moment, that's a hard environment in which to work, even with the Internet there, because the one that's going to get played out a lot is the one that, oh, my God, listen to what he said.
Well, I mean, there's polls show that many Republicans actually don't, majority believe things that simply aren't true. I mean, they don't believe in evolution anymore, and that's a different issue. But I think what's happened with Keystone, as the example we mentioned, is the environmental community did something very smart. They defined Keystone as the litmus test for Obama's commitment to climate change, so that, you know, if he approves that pipeline, it's like, we don't want to hear about anything else. You're a fraud. And that puts a lot of burden on him if he proceeds in that direction. It's hard to find those kind of litmus test issues, because the whole climate change thing is seen as so amorphous that environmentalists face a challenge that other groups don't face, which has a little more specific targets.
In the sense that you can't actually see you can see the effects of climate change, some people would argue, but that's a major problem.
Well, the question is, how do you pass a bill to change it? Mm-hmm. And it's one thing when you say, we can pass a bill that increases money to a program, we can pass a bill that stops a particular, we can pass a gun control bill, theoretically, if the political will was there. But, you know, when we did this omnibus climate change bill that passed the House in 2009, when you have an omnibus bill, it creates so much opposition because so many interest groups are implicated, right, that it's very difficult politically to get it through the Senate, ever. So they face it. So that's why I talk in the book how I think environmentalists have been a lot smarter in really targeting issues and holding officials accountable than they were in the 90s.
By picking very specific things that you can point to and say,
and
look, here's a problem.
Focused mm-hmm. and being more strategic in being proactive on stuff and identifying the issues instead of just letting the other side with industry has so much money. We've seen in California, we had a ballot measure. You have these, you know, a billionaire named Tom Steyer who's out there, got this whole solar thing passed. Now we're trying to do an oil extraction tax. And if you have the right strategies behind it, then suddenly the oil companies don't always win. And that's what the Activist Handbook is designed to do, to give us those, to people understand those strategies.
Randy Shaw is the author of The Activist's Handbook, now out in its second edition here on the Jefferson Exchange, well, in the whole world, but he's our guest here on the Jefferson Exchange. Let's talk about ballot initiatives then, because there is a chapter about that. There are always calls to change this system, that it's too easy to get stuff on the ballot, that the stuff is poorly written, et cetera, et cetera. It sounds like you're a lifelong Californian, where there's always been, in your lifetime, an initiative system, very similar one in Oregon.
Yeah, Oregon and California, I think, are maybe the two biggest initiative states in the country.
You can get just about anything on the ballot if you get enough people to sign your petitions.
Yeah.
Do you see abuses in the system? Are you pretty fine with it the way it is?
Well, you know, it's interesting. When I wrote the first edition, I was really kind of a distinct minority among progressives in supporting ballot initiatives, just basically saying we've accomplished a lot locally here in San Francisco, which I discuss in the book. And I also felt that it is a tool, so to act like it's this awful thing we don't want to deal with, it's a tool. The other side's going to use it, and you have to learn how to stop bad initiatives. You know, I think now with the, and then with the gay rights stuff, with Prop 208 that we had in 2008, which, you know, abolished the constitutional protection of gay marriage, people are really down on it. But now that gay marriage measures, you know, in 2012, they won around the country. And now that, you know, we passed, like in California, Prop 130 to raise taxes on the wealthy, minimum wage measures always pass, I think you're getting more people to see some value in it. I mean, obviously it's skewed toward the wealthy and all the reasons that people are critical, but it's a tool. And to say we're not going to pay attention to it is really bad, because you got to defeat the bad ones. I know Oregon has had a whole issue with your tax system, all the measures to restrict revenue, and you have to learn how to win these things.
Well, similar to Prop 13, Prop 13 paved the way. Right. Oregon followed 12 years later with Ballot Measure 5, which capped property tax rates and then went for cuts and assessments years later on. So.
Yeah.
Kind of a similar picture. So, but the, when in the part of the book when you talk about the rules for ballot initiatives, and number one is no other way. So this is really kind of a last resort way you look at things?
Well, I think so, because it is expensive, particularly at the state level. I mean, it's and also if you go to the ballot when people think there are other ways you could have done, it becomes a campaign theme. The opponent says, well, why did they go to the ballot? They could have done A, B, and C. And I should mention also, you know, all the people who talk about Prop 13 and the terrible things that happened in Oregon with the ballot measures that followed it, the legislature is passing a lot of terrible things, right? I mean, it's a function of a larger problem with who controls government and the like, with money, the power of big money. But I think our side is doing better in defeating bad measures than we've ever done before.
But that is an issue, not just for ballot initiatives, obviously. But, I mean, if you start a campaign on anything, if you act as an activist on any particular issue, you're going to find yourself at some point quite likely up against people who really have deeper pockets than you do. What are the best methods to, I mean, do you go ahead and publicize that all? Do you go ahead and put up the names of the people with the deep pockets?
The biggest message I have in the book is that when you know, as you say, that you're going to face big money, don't after the election say, well, you know, we got 40% of the vote, but we consider it a win because we're up against big money, because it's not a spring training game. It's the real thing. And, you know, don't go to the ballot unless you know you're going to have big money and you think you can overcome it. And I give a number of examples in the book. A campaign I worked on, we were outspent, you know, 30-1, and we won.
Was that the Proposition H thing?
This is the lowering the rent increases in San Francisco. But, you know, it becomes a convenient excuse for activists who really shouldn't have gone to the ballot because they had no chance of winning. Now, that's different from, there's a number of GMO measures, you know, genetically modified foods that are coming out that are losing the first time. Sometimes you have a case like the GMO issue where you might have to lose the first time because it's a public education purpose, but you can win the next time. So that's a different issue. But, you know, So people have to look at all the strategies involved, but let's not act like big. If you think big money is going to defeat you forever, don't go forward.
Let's take a call from Carter in Wolf Creek. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Randy Shaw, the author of The Activist's Handbook.
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
The question I have is, why is outside money allowed in these issues outside the state, when you have the legal concept of standing? Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah,
no, I know
so you
exactly get what you're saying, and I completely agree with where you're going.
So the issue is, if it's something going on in California, you don't want money coming from outside California.
No, it's crazy. You have somebody. No, it's crazy. There's an article today in the New York Times about this, about all this Koch brothers money coming into congressional districts around the country. It's disgraceful. It's allowed.
Let's take another call from Bill and Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Randy Shaw.
Hi, thanks for having me. Years ago, Oregon, there was a petition to get on a ballot. We got it on there that out-of-state money, people or whatever, could not pay people to collect petitions. And we voted it down. I think we're a bunch of idiots. So now out-of-state people can come in and pay all these people to collect signatures. And I just wonder how hard you think that would be to get back on the ballot so we could have another chance at it, and I think we've got smarter, and also possibly attached to it where nobody can be paid to collect signatures. Make it totally grassroots.
You know, that's been talked about. I will tell you, there's an initiative right now in San Francisco being circulated where petition gatherers are being paid $11 a signature.
Really?
Yeah. Boy. Think about that.
I'm on my way to San Francisco.
Big money interest. You know, what's happened with the signature business, and I talk about this in the book. When I wrote the first book, it used to be, say, a place like San Francisco, and it's probably true with Eugene. Everyone would just sign anything you put in front of them. Now, you can't get people to sign anything. Everyone's so skeptical, they all think they're corporate front groups, right? But the caller is correct. I mean, there's a lot of abuse. They've tried to get various changes and reforms about this exact issue he's talking about. But as long as you can pay people that kind of money, and you can't restrict where the money's coming from, you know, whether they're in, you're going to get in-state people to work for $11 a signature, because you could make $200 an hour.
I want to finish up by asking about media approaches, because obviously we're not in an age when people necessarily hold news conferences anymore, but it's also such a scattered media. I mean, if you're trying to get a bunch of people to focus on your message, how do you gather enough views of your stuff?
Well, that's a great point, and it's kind of a two-edged sword. We have so much media that your event, you know, I was saying how it's bad when we had a gatekeeper system on like three major, you know, TV networks or... But if you were on CBS News in the 1980s, everybody saw you, right? I mean, millions of people. Now you could be on, and they don't know. No, people aren't watching that channel because of the cable and everything. So it's a mixed blessing. The best thing, and I talk about this in the book, is to be strategic of who your audience is. When you have when you're doing activism, you're not trying to reach the broader public. You're trying to reach certain decision makers. What media influences them, and make sure that's the media you target your event toward.
Find where they are and go there.
Exactly.
The Activist Handbook, now in its second edition, Winning Social Change in the 21st Century. Randy Shaw wrote it. He's been our guest. Randy, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You bet. Tomorrow on the Jefferson Exchange at 8 o'clock, we'll talk about inmate releases and how they've been dropping in Lane County. We'll talk about the ICE a phone campaign designed to make seniors safer. And then we'll talk to the author of The Priority List. When you don't have much time left, you think, how do you prioritize? That's all tomorrow on the Jefferson Exchange. Our producer and today's engineer, Charlotte Duren. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Please join us again tomorrow at 8 for another edition of the Jefferson Exchange here on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. And have a great day.